They are opposed to a Palestinian state, which is much more refreshingly honest than some of those Israelis in the past who said, oh, yeah, we support a two-state solution while carrying on building the same settlements that Netanyahu and Smotrich and co. are doing. It just reminds us of how much gaslighting, Amy, there is in this country, in our media, in our Congress, where Democrats in particular hide behind the two-state solution crutch. Oh, yes, my solution, but a two-state solution. Well, there is no two-state solution. The Israeli government says there is no two-state solution. They are doing everything in their power to make sure that a two-state solution can never happen practically by, you know, cutting up the land, building Israeli settlements that will prevent the establishment of any future Palestinian state. So in that sense, you know, thank you, Netanyahu, for saying what we already knew, that you are someone who's opposed to a Palestinian state, who has blocked a Palestinian state multiple times, including right now. By the way, Amy, I should also point out, Bezalel Smotrich is the one who announced those settlements in the West Bank, and Netanyahu is now echoing what Smotrich says. Again, there's a faction in this country that wants to say, oh, ignore Smotrich, he's just a fringe figure. No, Bezalel Smotrich is the finance minister of Israel. He's in control of the West Bank. And what he's doing, Netanyahu is following. So this is the entire Israeli government. This is their worldview. By the way, you mentioned 1,500 people taken in the West Bank. I mean, there's a word for that. It's called hostages. There are Palestinian hostages being held by Israel without charge, disappeared. No one knows where they are. They've committed no crimes. They are hostages in the same way that the people Hamas took were hostages.
I wanted to also switch to another issue. Last week, the U.S. attacked the boat in the Southern Caribbean, killing at least 11 people. President Trump claimed the boat was carrying drugs from Venezuela, but offered no proof. The Pentagon recently sent warships to the region after Trump secretly authorized use of military force in Latin America under the guise of the war on drugs. In response, Congressmember Ilhan Omar has introduced a new war powers resolution seeking to block the Trump administration from conducting future military strikes in the Caribbean. This is Congressmember Omar speaking to you, Mehdi, Thursday in a Zeteo town hall.
It is Congress that declares war, and we have not been given that authority by this president. And it's, I think, really important for us to insert our authority in declaring war. What we are seeing with multiple strikes throughout the world that the president has authorized is that he does not have the authority to be able to do so. And specifically, this strike that was carried out in the Caribbean against the Venezuelan vessel, I think it's important for the people to recognize that we cannot just go out and terminate people. You know, this is not something that is allowed under international law, and is certainly not allowed under U.S. law.
So that's Ilhan Omar speaking to you, Mehdi. AP is reporting the Venezuelan boat was heading back to shore when the Trump administration bombed it, and that might have been bombed twice. And the whole question being raised, if it was a drug boat, why were there so many people on it? Were these, in fact, migrants? Mehdi Hassan, the significance of what's taken place, and also the latest news that the House passed legislation to repeal the 1991 and 2002 Iraq authorizations for use of military force, the AUMF, in a bipartisan vote Wednesday, moving against two pieces of legislation that have vastly expanded the president's ability to use military force in the U.S.'s forever wars in the Middle East.
Well, let's start with the AUMFs that you mentioned. Yes, they have been used to expand power and force of the U.S. state. They have been abused by presidents of both parties, stretched beyond all imaginable use based on the original intent of those AUMFs. I'm glad they were repealed, but look at how long it took. You know, over 20 years for the War on Terror one, for the 2002 one for Iraq, over 30 years for the original Gulf War one. This is why I'm skeptical that Ilhan Omar's war powers resolution will go anywhere. She's much more optimistic than I am. I interviewed her yesterday, as you showed. She thinks she'll get a lot of votes for it. Unfortunately, our Congress loves endless war. Our Congress loves to hand over its war-making power to the president, both parties. And therefore, it is very worrying when you have a president like Donald Trump in the White House and the power he has. And, you know, Barack Obama, with his drone strike policy, laid the groundwork for Donald Trump's drone strike policy. Donald Trump, in his first term, actually carried out more drone strikes than Barack Obama did in his two terms. People don't know that, but of course, all of that was set up for Trump. And you look at that boat attack, it does look more and more like an act of mass murder. 11 people killed. We don't know their names. We don't know who they were. We don't know what they are supposedly accused of. Just a generic, they are narco-terrorists. They are drug traffickers. Based on what? The whole point of the United States is that the president doesn't just get to kill people and we believe him on his say-so, especially this president who lies about everything. We just learned recently, Amy, from the New York Times that in his first term, he sent the SEALs into North Korea to plant a listening device, and those Navy SEALs ended up killing a boat full of unarmed Koreans, North Koreans, and then coming out and not telling the world, not telling the United States, not telling Congress. So why would we believe anything Donald Trump says on the national security front? You trust Marco Rubio? You trust Peter Hegseth? You trust Donald Trump? No. In fact, the New York Times is reporting this week that the boat was turning around and they still attacked it. This was a boat that was 2,000 miles away from the U.S. coastline. There's no scenario in which you can say it was an imminent threat to the U.S. That's why we attacked it. It was thousands of miles away and it was heading in the other direction. And as you say, had 11 people on board, which is very strange. Most drug boats don't have that many people on board. So I hope there is some kind of investigation, an international one, if not a U.S. one, because it looks like Donald Trump may have just murdered 11 innocent people.
Mehdi Hasan, I want to thank you for being with us, award-winning journalist, editor-in-chief, and CEO of Zatteo. We'll link to your new piece, Hypocritical Conservatives Are Using Charlie Kirk's Horrific Murder to Cynically Smear the Left. Again, this breaking news, President Trump says that the suspected shooter is in custody. And also this breaking news, Trump says he'll send the National Guard to Memphis, Tennessee. Coming up, Brazil's Supreme Court has sentenced former President Jair Bolsonaro to 27 years in prison after being convicted of plotting a coup to remain in power after losing the 2022 election. Stay with us.
When my way grows drear, precious Lord, linger near. When my life is almost gone, hear my cry, hear my call.
Late great Odetta performing in our firehouse studio, September 11th, 2002, a year after the September 11th attacks. Yesterday was the 24th anniversary of those attacks. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Brazil, where a panel of Supreme Court justices has sentenced former President Jair Bolsonaro to more than 27 years in prison for plotting a military coup and seeking to annihilate democracy in Brazil following Bolsonaro's election defeat in 2022. A panel of five Brazilian court justices handed down the sentence just hours after reaching the historic verdict, which marks the first time a former head of state in Brazil is brought to trial and convicted of attempting to overthrow the government. Bolsonaro and his co-conspirators, who were also sentenced to prison, hatched a plan that would involve using armed forces personnel to assassinate the president-elect, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, and Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes. The court also detailed attempts by Bolsonaro to cast doubt on Brazil's electoral system, leading to the January 8th riots back in 2023, when thousands of Bolsonaro supporters attacked government buildings. This is the Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Carmen Lucia explaining the verdict.
Fez prova cabal.
The prosecutor's office provided conclusive evidence that a group led by Jair Messias Bolsonaro, compromised of key figures from the government, the armed forces, and the intelligence services, implemented a progressive and systematic plan to attack democratic institutions with the aim of harming the legitimate transfer of power in the 2022 elections.
That's Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Carmen Lucia. We now turn to Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, who Bolsonaro planned to assassinate. He said, while announcing the sentence, that Bolsonaro had attempted to, quote, annihilate the essential pillars of the democratic rule of law state. The greatest consequence would have been the return of dictatorship to Brazil, Moraes said. Bolsonaro has been under house arrest in Brasilia since August and will not be required to report to prison until he's exhausted all appeals to his conviction. Bolsonaro is a staunch ally of President Trump, who described the case against Bolsonaro as a witch hunt, imposing 50% tariffs on Brazil and sanctioning the Brazilian Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes in retaliation. Trump said he's very unhappy with the verdict and called Bolsonaro an outstanding man. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Marco Rubio threatened the United States would, quote, respond accordingly to this witch hunt. Back in Brazil, opponents of Bolsonaro took to the streets in Brasilia, Rio de Janeiro, and other major cities celebrating the historic verdict. For more, we're joined here in New York by Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, visiting scholar at City University of New York Graduate Center. Welcome back to Democracy Now! The significance of this verdict and the sentence of more than 20 years for Bolsonaro.
Yes, that's a very important moment. It's a historic moment in Brazil. As you know, Amy, Brazil had over 20 years of a military dictatorship, and the return to democracy was only about 40 years ago. So it's a very young democracy. So that's why it's so important that the Supreme Court in Brazil didn't leave this crime in impunity. So it's very important to set this record and the precedent in Brazil so we defend our democracy and we defend our democratic institutions, because the attempted coup was not only against the elections when President Lula was elected, but against all democratic institutions in the country, including the Supreme Court.
Talk about exactly what happened back in 2023.
Well, there was a whole what the Supreme Court showed with the proofs and the evidence was that that was a plot that took over a year. So they described step by step all the ways in which the Bolsonaro and his allies plot this attempted coup that culminated in a mob attacking institutions in Brasilia, the building of the Congress and the building of the Supreme Court, and destroying property. So at the same time, there was this plot to assassinate President Lula and his vice president, Geraldo Alckmin, and Alexandre de Moraes, the Supreme Court justice. So it was a very broad what they described, what the Supreme Court described was a criminal organization that took several steps to remain in power.
And the significance of the pressure the United States is trying to put on Brazil, the 50% tariffs, who knows what they'll do now. And it looks like very much the identification President Trump has with Bolsonaro. There, it was January 8th attempted coup. In the United States, it was January 6th. I wanted to go to Trump talking to reporters who was asked about the Bolsonaro conviction.
Well, I watched that trial. I know him pretty well. Foreign leader. He was a good, I thought he was a good president of Brazil. And it's very surprising that that could happen. That's very much like they tried to do with me, but they didn't get away with it at all. But I can only say this. I knew him as president of Brazil. He was a good man.
So that's Donald Trump. But his opinion is his opinion. But the, what the U.S. policy is now in putting pressure on Brazil, what that means.
Yes, the U.S. claimed that the 50% tariffs on Brazil was because of trade imbalance. But actually, the U.S. has a trade surplus with Brazil. So it's definitely a political pressure against the judiciary in Brazil. So the Supreme Court didn't take that. So at the same time, the Brazilian government took measures to so the economy in Brazil would not suffer very much from the tariffs. So I think the response from the Brazilian government and from the Supreme Court was to say that Brazil is an independent country and is not a colony anymore. So the exact words that they use is that Brazil is not a banana republic. So they stood up, and that was a very important point.
I wanted to go to Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva speaking during a televised address last weekend before the verdict in the sentence.
We will resist any attempt to undermine it. The role of some Brazilian politicians who encourage attacks on Brazil is unacceptable. They were elected to serve the Brazilian people, but they only defend their own interests. They are traitors to the nation. History will not forgive them.
So that's Lula.
Yes, I think it was very important that the Brazilian government took measures to protect the Brazilian economy and to protect the rule of law. And at the same time that the justices during the trial mentioned that they would not be intimidated, that a tweet from a foreign government would not change the course of a trial in Brazil where they had vast evidence of the crimes that Bolsonaro is facing now.
As director of the Network for Social Justice, what does this verdict mean for activists, for indigenous communities, for marginalized groups who are particularly targeted and threatened during Bolsonaro's presidency?
Yeah, that's very important because Bolsonaro dismantled several important institutions, environmental institutions, human rights institutions. So that is reaffirming that Brazil is not going to accept going back to a system of oppression and dictatorship. So social movements in Brazil are celebrating, and everyone who defends human rights should be celebrating as well.
And finally, the message to the world around the issue of democracies grappling with the rise of far-right leaders who refuse to accept electoral defeats?
Exactly. I remember, Amy, in 2016, we had this conversation during the parliamentary coup against President Dilma. And at that time, the Supreme Court actually went along with the coup against Dilma. But Bolsonaro—
You're talking about former Brazilian president who was impeached, Dilma Rousseff.
Exactly. But Bolsonaro was so extreme, his policies were so extreme, that the Supreme Court, the mainstream media, also felt that he went too far. So even those institutions now understand that it's very important to defend democracy. And I think that all the events that took place since the attempted parliamentary coup in Brazil and when Dilma Rousseff, former president, was impeached, now we feel that that is a conciliation with that history, the recent history, as well as with the two-decade-old military dictatorship that we had in Brazil that imposed so much violence in the country.
Finally, are you concerned about the U.S.'s actions right now towards Venezuela under the guise of the war on drugs, the blowing up of the ship, the positioning of U.S. military warships? Do you think that could extend to Brazil?
Well, I think that Latin America needs to be united. Latin American countries need to be united and have a very strong position to defend democracy and to defend our sovereignty and independence. So, and I think that it's very important also to build solidarity with human rights organizations in the U.S. and people who defend democracy here in the U.S. and in Latin America.
Maria Luisa Mendonca, we thank you so much for being with us, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, visiting scholar here in New York at City University of New York Graduate Center. Coming up, we go to Nepal, where 51 people have been killed in youth-led anti-corruption protests. Back in 20 seconds.
Tus monólogos, tus discursos incoloros. No ves que no estamos solos. Millones de polo a polo, al son de un solo coro. Marcharemos con el tono, con la convicción. Que basta de robo, tu estado de control, tu trono podrido de oro. Tu política y tu riqueza y tu tesoro. No, la hora sonó, la hora sonó. No permitiremos más, más tu doctrina del shock. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó, la hora sonó. La hora sonó. No hay países, solo corporaciones. ¿Quién tiene más, más, más acciones? Trozos gordos, poderos, decisiones por muy pocos. Constitución pinochetista, derecho Busdey, la fascista. Golpista disfrazado de un indulto elitista. Cae la gota, la gota se toma la máquina rota. La calle no calle, la calle no calle, la calle se raya.
Shock by the Chilean musician Ana Tijoux performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Nepal, where the country's former Chief Justice, Sushila Karki, looks set to become the interim prime minister following massive youth-led anti-corruption demonstrations. Protesters set fire to the parliament, other government buildings Tuesday amidst a police crackdown. Officials said today at least 51 people have been killed, including 21 protesters. The protests continued even after the government lifted its ban on social media platforms and after Prime Minister KP Sharma Ali resigned.
Everything that has happened is not because of the social ban. We need a young leader now. We are looking for change. Time is up for these old leaders. We don't need them. We need the youth.
For more, we go to the capital of Nepal, to Kathmandu, where we're joined by journalist Pranay Rana. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you describe the scene right now in the streets and the significance of what has happened in these youth-led protests, but also this terrible death toll of at least 51 people?
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me. So right now I'm in Kathmandu. We are still under curfew and prohibitory orders. The Nepal army is out on the streets patrolling. And we are really in a state of confusion, as we don't really know what is happening at the moment or where the country will go in, since most of our state institutions have been either destroyed or are non-functional. So we really are counting on the new generation, the Gen Z, who led the protests to take us forward. Right now, negotiations are going on between former Chief Justice Sushila Karki and President Ramchandra Portal. They are expected to hash out a deal by today for Madam Karki to become the interim prime minister and lead the country towards fresh elections within 6 months.
And who is she? Who is this new interim prime minister, and how did the students feel, the youth feel about her?
So Madam Sushila Karki, she's a former chief justice. She's the only female chief justice in Nepal's history. She retired in 2017 after facing an impeachment motion by the political parties who have been kicked out of power right now. The impeachment motion did go through parliament, but it was nullified by the Supreme Court for not being in line with the constitution. So Madam Karki has always, she has cultivated a reputation for being very anti-corruption. And she also believes that the political parties should hand over leadership to the next generation. So that's why her stances resonate with the younger generation, the Gen Z, who have led these protests. She was also one of the few senior leaders of the country who came to the streets to protest the 19, now 21, young protesters who were killed on September 8th.
Can you talk about the government shutting down some 26 social media platforms and how that intensified the protests and why they focused on social media?
Well, the social media ban has been in the works for a number of years now. The successive Nepal governments have tried to get social media networks to register within Nepal and appoint a local representative here so that they can reach out easier when they need to take down offensive material. Most of the tech giants, Meta, Alphabet, and all the other ones, they've all refused. Either they've ignored the request or they've straight up refused, saying that there is no law. So the Nepal government has been trying to get them registered based on a directive that the executive issued, which the directive is not an act passed by parliament. So a few social media companies have argued that if there is no law in place, we can't register. So most recently, what happened was that the Nepal government gave the social media companies a 7-day ultimatum, a 7-day deadline to register, if threatening to ban them if they did not. The 7-day deadline passed with no one registering, so the government moved ahead with the ban. The ban happened to coincide with a widely youth-led movement on social media against corruption and against nepotism, especially of the children of the politicians who are currently in power. So the youth felt that the social media ban was one more attempt by the government to suppress their voices, take away their free speech, especially because they were criticizing the politicians' families. So that was the immediate trigger for the protests.
Pranay, finally, can you talk about the economy? The economic despair felt by so many in Nepal today. For most Nepalis, the main source of income is remittances from their relatives working abroad. And then put it in a regional context. Over these years, these youth-led rebellions, particularly also around the economy, you have Sri Lanka in 2022, Bangladesh, its July revolution, throwing out Sheikh Hasina, most recently Indonesia, and the spark being the killing of a 21-year-old delivery driver that led to so much protest. Talk first about Nepal.
Yes. So as I said, the Nepali economy basically depends completely on remittances that are sent back by migrant workers, most of whom are in the Gulf states or in Malaysia or in South Korea, where they work labor jobs. Remittances equal about 25% of our GDP. So that's how important remittances are to this country. But sadly, most youth feel that they have no future here. They cannot make the amount of money that they would make doing a manual labor job in, say, Qatar or Saudi Arabia. They cannot make the same amount of money working even a decent job or a blue-collar job here in Nepal. So that resentment has been building. Even students feel that they cannot get a job here in Nepal, so they choose to migrate to foreign lands immediately upon graduating high school or graduating college.
I want to thank you so much, Pranay. We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue these discussions because this regional context is so important. Pranay Rana is a writer and journalist based in Kathmandu, Nepal. And as we wrap up our broadcast, the late breaking news on the murder of the conservative activist Charlie Kirk. CNN's confirmed law enforcement has a man in custody who confessed to his father about shooting Kirk. The father reportedly told authorities and said he had secured his son until he could be formally detained. This morning, President Trump said on Fox News, quote, somebody very close to him turned him in. The person was involved with law enforcement, was a person of faith, a minister, and brought him to a U.S. Marshal who was fantastic. They drove into the police headquarters, and he's there now, Trump said. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
And now for a CJSF Heritage Minute. Simon Fraser University, the 1960s. In the earliest days of SFU, a renegade unlicensed radio station begins broadcasting around campus. 1974. Volunteers establish the Simon Fraser Campus Radio Society, which operates CJSF to this day. 1985.